Ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure to welcome you all on behalf of the Dean Chapter to this first of a series of three lectures during our celebration of the 500th anniversary of the consecration of this chapel. We had a beautiful Requiem Mass for Henry VII here with a lot of incense and plain chant last Thursday. It was a remarkable occasion. I also managed to get into my sermon reference to the fact that it was also the 90th anniversary of the Queen's birth. Then last night we had a beautiful recital by the Abbey Choir of music, Marian music, from the 16th century until the present day. So now we're going to focus on the architecture of this wonder of the entire world, as a near contemporary called it, this remarkable building. And then afterwards, Lady Margaret Beaufort, and then James I in successive lectures. Professor Christopher Wilson, who is honouring us with his presence in his lecture this evening, is Emeritus Professor of Architectural History at UCL, where he taught medieval architecture in the period 1100 to 1500. His numerous publications include The Gothic Cathedral, published in 1990, and writings on the Shrine of St. William of York, the architecture of Melrose Abbey, and the royal lodgings of Edward III at Windsor Castle. But Westminster has been a recurrent theme in his work. He's written about Richard II's remodeling of Westminster Hall, and is a particularly fitting lecturer for this occasion, having contributed an essay on the design of Henry VII's Lady Chapel for the volume of essays on the chapel published in 2003 to mark the 500th anniversary of the laying that year of the chapel's foundation stone. There will be an opportunity, if people have questions at the end, to ask one or two questions, but now it's a great pleasure to introduce Professor Christopher Wilson.
Thank you very much, Mr. Dean. Let me start by saying what a great honour and pleasure it is to be here, yes, here, actually giving a lecture about a building in the building, and this is, as I hope will emerge in the course of my lecture, this is one of my favourite buildings. Practically all the historians who have written about Henry VII have had difficulty making up their minds what was most important about him. That he was important is, of course, not in doubt, as he succeeded in bringing to an end the decades of political turmoil which we know as the Wars of the Roses, and he succeeded in placing his descendants on the throne of England. Part of the problem is that his reign has been seen to mark the end of the Middle Ages and the beginning of the early modern period, and for this reason much ink has been spilled in trying to discern which aspects of him and his reign belong to the late medieval world and which to the Renaissance. Recently, he has been thought to exemplify liminality, a term borrowed from, notice the sort of tongs I'm holding that word, but a term borrowed from anthropology and the sort of buzzword beloved of fad-prone academics. The word comes from the Latin limen, a threshold, and viewing Henry VII through the prism of liminality seems to me wholly unenlightening, not least because he would have been on or near the threshold between the late Middle Ages and early modern times, even if he had done nothing at all that was notable. In his 24 years on the throne, Henry had many difficult problems to wrestle with, but deciding whether he belonged to the Middle Ages or to the Renaissance was clearly not one of them. I do not intend to waste any more time pigeonholing Henry VII in this way, except to say that he showed himself open to innovatory possibilities in a wide range of fields, including the visual arts. Another cause of the marginalisation of Henry VII's reign in general histories of England is that it does not fit into the grand narrative of the gradual growth of the power of Parliament and the diminution of the monarch's power. There can be little doubt that Henry VII wanted from an early stage to minimise the role of Parliament, and in his last 12 years, he summoned it only once. I would characterise his style of rule as benign autocracy, but in making that value judgment, I'm anticipating what I want to say in a few moments' time about the contemporary perceptions of his qualities as king. I now encounter technology. I've already forgotten what I'm supposed to do, but let's have a go. Oh, too much vigour. There we are. In attempting to characterise Henry VII's personality and rule, historians have had recourse to three different strategies. The first of these is to make him into a puzzle, an enigma. The second is to caricature or even vilify him. And the third is to treat him as a pale foreshadowing of what was to come later in the 16th century. The enigma option is prominent in the remarkable history of Henry VII's reign published by Francis Bacon in 1622. In part, Bacon's view that Henry's personality was inscrutable was due to the relative paucity of documentary sources providing insights into the king's opinions, reactions, and motivations, a paucity which remains to this day a difficulty for the student. But the inscrutability hypothesis does have some basis in reality, for Henry can be said to have been in some respects a very private person. Being pestered by petitioners was something that most kings of England and France tolerated out of considerations of noblesse oblige, but Henry evidently found it intolerable. In the mid-1490s, he made his chamber almost impregnably remote from the court at large, although that change had as much to do with financial reform as with a desire for privacy. After the death in February 1503 of Queen Elizabeth, to whom he was undoubtedly devoted, he hid himself away and saw almost no one during a considerable period. All the same, Henry was generally thought a most affable man, and there is plenty of evidence of his ability to enjoy himself, particularly with his favourite pastimes of hunting and playing cards. The second option, the caricaturing or vilificatory approach, was inaugurated by Thomas More, no less. Someone got that. After the death of Henry VII in April 1509, More branched out as a prince-pleasing poet with a set of Latin verses hailing the accession of Henry VIII as a bright new dawn. The 17-year-old paragon at the centre of More's effusions was also the recipient of the poems, but that did not deter More from contrasting the new king with his benighted and avaricious father, who had over many years extorted money from the nobility and from London merchants alike. If it was More who launched the caricature of Henry VII as a money-grubbing and joyless miser on its seemingly interminable career, it was Francis Bacon who developed it and ensured that its influence pervades both scholarly and popular writing even today. The grain of truth that both More and Bacon were building on was Henry VII's system of imposing bonds or recognizances on wealthy individuals whom he had in his sights in order to ensure their good behavior. This ingenious system was utterly unparalleled, and it died with the king. Of course, it's easy to see how, in the hands of someone less self-disciplined than Henry, his system could have become an instrument of tyranny. But as Stanley Crimes put it in his authoritative 1972 biography, to seek to control his subjects by getting at their purse strings was better than the more violent forms of terrorism that had been not uncommon in the past and were to reappear in magnified form in the times of his successors. It's worth mentioning in passing that Henry VII was the only medieval or early modern English monarch who forbade the use of torture. Although the notion that Henry was interested in accumulating money for its own sake rather than for the power and freedom of action that it gave him is unfounded, many of his contemporaries would have thought it demeaning that a king should have been ready to oversee the financial machinery of the state in the minute detail that he is famous for. The chivalric code required all great lords, including kings, to be not only affable but dispendious. Henry was certainly alive to the importance of dispendiousness, as witnessed the torrents of silver and gold plate that poured into the hands of the Spanish delegation attending the marriage of Prince Arthur and Catherine of Aragon in 1502. Although there's every reason to suppose that these sorts of gestures were performed with the affability that was frequently remarked on by foreign ambassadors, they will have been thought of by all concerned as an indispensable part of princely magnificence and ultimately components of political calculation. In the architectural sphere, there is at least one example of Henry's keenness to save money in a way that would have little or no adverse effect on his carefully fashioned aura of magnificence. This is his persuading of his closest counsellor and best friend, Sir Reynold Bray, to pay for much of the nave of St. George's Chapel in Windsor Castle. In return, Henry allowed Bray to be buried there and to have many of the vault bosses decorated with carvings of his personal device. Bray was, of course, a Garter Knight, but as well as being rich, he was childless and therefore well able to afford to fund the work. Whatever might have been the methods employed by Henry to persuade Bray to make a major contribution to the building of a royal church, flattery, cajoling, exploitation, and arm-twisting are all possibilities, there is no getting away from the clever and manipulative basis of this move of his. The third option, that of treating Henry VII as a mere foreshadowing of the glories to come in the reigns of Henry VIII and Elizabeth I, is predominant in the conclusion of Sidney Crimes's monograph I mentioned a moment ago, and it finds powerful echoes in serious historical writing today. This teleological approach is one which I have to admit I find intensely irritating. To me, as an architectural historian, it is blindingly obvious that the buildings erected for Henry VII occupy an entirely different artistic plane from those put up for Henry VIII or Elizabeth I. Certainly, Henry VIII's confiscation of church property enabled him to build vastly more than his father had done, but as I wrote in 2003 and have no reason not to repeat now, with only one exception, Henry VIII's houses were not innovatory in their external architecture or their planning, and most were rambling and visually chaotic structures built piecemeal in response to the unpremeditated urgings of this most impulsive king. The exception was the Palace of Nonsuch in Surrey, but this made extensive use of impermanent materials and was not destined to survive. The visual art most patronized by Elizabeth I was her distinctive version of haute couture. But as far as architecture was concerned, she was a skinflint, barely even maintaining the vast stock of royal residences put up for her father. Her main contribution is likely to have been the widening of internal doors needed to enable her to pass from one room to another wearing the very wide-skirted dresses that came into fashion in the early 1570s. That's her attended to. To what extent Henry VII's qualities as a man and as a ruler were due to character traits inherited from his truly extraordinary and admirable mother, Lady Margaret Beaufort, and how far they were influenced by his insecure early life are self-evidently things that we cannot possibly know. What does seem clear is that those two factors together were enormously important. His exile in Brittany and France between 1471 and 1485 cannot have failed to have had a great impact on him, for he was 14 years old when he left and 28 when his forces triumphed at the Battle of Bosworth. His watchfulness, his pleasing demeanor towards strangers, his self-reliance, his general reluctance to reveal more of himself than was necessary, his resilience and tenacity, and his readiness to exploit unforeseen opportunities, all of these traits are likely to have developed in response to being not merely an exile, but a piece of potentially expendable political capital. In Brittany, his host, if that's the right word, was Duke Francis II, who maintained a brilliant court and who was an enthusiastic builder. Henry's escape from Brittany to the court of the teenage Charles VIII of France in September 1484 will have further widened his horizons both politically and culturally. Over and above the impressions of individual buildings that he might have received during his enforced travels, there is at least one general aspect of Henry VII's architectural patronage which makes sense as the response of a king who was unique in having spent a long time out of England before his accession. This is his refusal to follow the 100-year-old practice of issuing patents to master craftsmen who are charged with general responsibility for all activity relating to their craft within the king's works, the organization responsible for erecting and maintaining buildings for the king's use. In the course of the 15th century, this organizational structure had ceased to correspond to reality in that the most ambitious royal building projects, King's College, Cambridge, the Chapel of Eton College, and St. George's Chapel, Windsor, were all at some distance from London and were all under the direction of architects who were not the King's chief master mason. This anomaly would have been obvious to anyone who, like Henry VII, had grown to maturity far away from Westminster and who was prepared to look hard at some of the time-honoured ways of doing things in the Royal Works organisation. It is potentially a great impediment to our understanding of the Lady Chapel of Westminster Abbey that Henry VII refused to appoint a King's Master Mason with global responsibility. For this, coupled with the loss of all the building accounts for the chapel, makes it a less than straightforward matter to identify the architect. In fact, the only extant written document that has a bearing on the problem is a note datable to 1506, which lists the estimated costs of making a monument for the king. The estimate for the stonework of the proposed tomb was made jointly by three men styled the King's Three Master Masons, namely Robert Virtue, Robert Jannins, and John Le Bons, in that order. Later on, I will present some of the stylistic evidence that indicates pretty conclusively that it was the Oxford-based architect Robert Jannins who had responsibility for the design. I must turn now to the Lady Chapel itself. The loss of all the building accounts means that even some aspects of the basic chronology are unclear. The Elizabethan chronicler Raphael Holinshed, who is chiefly remembered today as an influence on Shakespeare's historical plays, tells us in his chronicle published in 1577 that the foundation stone was laid on the 24th of January 1503. According to Holinshed, the inscription on the stone, which was almost certainly part of the below-ground foundations of the building, stated that it was laid by Henry VII himself, and the fact that it was actually laid by the Abbot of Westminster, John Islip, and others, suggests to me that the king was absent because he was already aware that all was not well with the pregnancy of the queen, who was to die shortly after giving birth on 11th of February. The payments for the chapel in the King's Chamber accounts make a total of just under £15,000. By far the highest expenditure was in 1508, when nearly £4,000 was spent. This suggests that 1508 saw the construction of the high vault, and in fact there is more than one piece of circumstantial evidence that the chapel was structurally complete by the summer of 1508. The creation of something so large and complex in just over 5 years was, of course, a tremendous feat. But it is clear that the king was using his right of impressment, for there is documentary evidence that masons were impressed from Peterborough Abbey, where a magnificent fan-vaulted eastern extension was in progress. The 500th anniversary of the dedication of the chapel that is being celebrated this year is based on an entry in the little-known chronicle of Thomas Gardiner, a monk of Westminster and a very distant relation of Henry VII. Gardiner is, in fact, our only source for the dedication of the chapel on 19th of February 1516, which I think I'm right in saying was not known at Westminster until the publication of my paper in a collective work on the chapel that came out in 2003. I'm extremely grateful to my friend Nigel Ramsay, who I haven't seen, but I think he's present this evening, who told me of this neglected record. It seems reasonable to assume that all the fittings of the chapel were complete by the start of 1516. Although Henry VII lived to see the completed structure, the fittings were far from complete when he died in April 1509. We know from his will that the bronze grille enclosing his tomb was incomplete at the time of his death, and also that the stained glass had not yet been begun. This evening I want to discuss only what was done in Henry VII's time or in accordance with his intentions. This means, for example, that I shall not be considering his monument at all. In 1506, a design for it had been produced by the North Italian sculptor Guido Mazzoni, who had designed the enameled bronze tomb of Charles VIII, destroyed during the French Revolution. The tomb we see today is the work of the Florentine sculptor Pietro Torrigiano, who was only recruited by the king's executors in 1512. I want to start my detailed consideration of the building by discussing the functions that it was intended to fulfill. These were far more than in any earlier lady chapel, and they were very varied. Of course, this was first and foremost the Abbey's principal chapel dedicated to Our Lady, and it replaced a simpler and smaller chapel built on the same site in the early 13th century, partly at the expense of King Henry III. In the Middle Ages, the cult of the Virgin Mary simply grew and grew in importance. And one measure of that phenomenon in England is that this is not the only instance of the replacing of a 13th century lady chapel by a larger and more elaborate structure in late medieval times. By the late 14th century, lady chapels in major churches had become the setting for immensely ambitious and sophisticated polyphonic music, performed partly by professional singers and partly by boys from the almonry school selected for the excellence of their singing voices. We can be sure that this chapel resounded for at least the first 35 years of its existence to magnificent music, although, so far as I know, not one note of this has survived. This music will have been performed by a small ensemble of singers clustered around a lectern placed immediately before the main altar in the chapel, which was, of course, that dedicated to the Virgin. Working out exactly where in the chapel Henry VII intended the principal altar and the other main fittings to stand is not straightforward, because after Henry died, the positioning of the fittings in the main central space of the chapel was changed into what we see today, which is definitely not what Henry had wanted. Another problem is that the architecture embodies a system whose consistent application was an end in itself and is therefore totally devoid of the sort of clues to the positioning of altars that one finds in, for example, the side chapels of the main Abbey Church at Westminster. One might expect to find traces of a screen extending across the chapel, the sort of structure that remains in place behind the high altar of the main Abbey Church, but in fact there are no such traces, and nothing of the kind can ever have existed. The only clue is to be found in the very lowest level of the great arch between the apse and the rest of the chapel, where there are the chapel's only image niches to be conceived as pairs. This pairing is clearly expressed by the bold ogee arches above them. Goodness. My ability to render this kind of thing sort of non-effective is legendary, but I thought there was a point of it. Anyway, let's do it. That is what I'm talking about. You see, they're grouped, and you can just about see them, even. The arrows on the plan are pointing towards the northern pair of niches, which is shown on the right. I suggest that the paired niches contained imagery showing the Visitation and the Annunciation, and this would have enabled them to serve as a kind of liturgical marker. Today, few people spare these empty niches a glance, for they were clumsily overlapped when the choir stalls were extended eastwards in the 18th century. The position I have proposed for the main altar is well to the west of where it could have been if it had not been necessary to accommodate the shrine of the canonized King Henry VI. More of that anon. The shrine is shown at A, and I've added one of my clunky blue arrows to help you out, on the reconstructed plan on the left. The process of canonizing Henry VI was started under pressure from Henry VII, but it languished under Henry VIII, and the king's body remained in St. George's, Windsor, where it still remains today. Canonizing and enshrining his step-uncle and making a monument for himself near to the shrine had been Henry VII's aims when, sometime in the early 1490s, he started to rebuild the 13th and 14th century chapel of St. Mary and St. Edward as a lady chapel attached to the east end of St. George's. And you see this chapel in the right-hand image on the extreme right. I didn't realize I was going to be quite so close to the screen, so I put in these rather elaborate clues, that building there. By July 1498, the king had become persuaded that Henry VI had intended in his lifetime to be buried at Westminster, and he therefore abandoned work on the Windsor Lady Chapel and declared his intention of rebuilding the Lady Chapel at Westminster for the same purpose. There really isn't anywhere else that the shrine of St. Henry could have stood other than the place I have given it on my plan. In later medieval England, major saints' shrines were invariably placed a short way to the east of the main altar. The shrine of St. Edward in the eastern arm of the main Abbey Church is an example of that usage. You may think it rather perverse of me to devote so much time to an aspect of Henry VII's plans which never materialized, but the creation of a shrine for the canonized Henry VI was the starting point of the entire scheme, and it, rather than the tomb of Henry VII and his queen, would have formed the spiritual and physical climax, especially for those visiting the chapel as pilgrims. There is plenty of evidence that the cult of Henry VI was popular in England in the late 15th and early 16th centuries, and in choosing Westminster as the future focus of that cult, Henry VII will have been intending to revitalize the institution which the Venetian ambassador described in the 1490s as being in the forefront of the English world. The need to provide for pilgrims probably explains a unique feature of the west wall of the chapel, the inclusion of three portals filling the entire width available. Enshrining St. Henry next to his own tomb would have served to glorify immeasurably the Lancastrian line of kings to which Henry VII considered that he belonged. There was, of course, no talk in his lifetime of a Tudor dynasty. The shrine would have been a source of pecuniary profit to the abbey, but even though the shrine and the profits never arrived, the endowments made in anticipation of the translation of St. Henry's relics by Henry VII and his mother, Lady Margaret Beaufort, constituted a financial rescue package for the abbey. As Barbara Harvey has explained, but for the bounty of Henry VII and the Countess of Richmond, the early Tudor inflation would have hit the monks hard. Their actual income was probably around 11% higher in 1535 than it had been when Henry VII and his mother first turned their thoughts to the abbey. The documents that provide most information about Henry VII intended the chapel to function are the indentures. These are highly remarkable artifacts in their own right and have been cherished as such by their owners, even though their provisions lapsed in 1547 on the accession of the religiously ultra-radical and iconophobic Edward VI. The slide shows the abbey's copy. I do not know any other examples of entire books which are treated as indentures. This was presumably a device for underlining the solemnity of the agreements framed by the text. The indentures, which were drawn up in 1504, are concerned neither with the Lady Chapel services nor with the shrine of St. Henry, but with the commemoration of Henry VII and his queen. The level of detail is astonishing, both in relation to objects and the actions which were to be performed in the vicinity of those objects. It is only when one reads the indentures that it becomes clear what roles were to be fulfilled by the bronze enclosure that surrounds the tomb of the king and queen. In functional terms, it was indistinguishable from the many English examples of the so-called cage type of chantry chapel containing a tomb and an altar to the east of the tomb, which was to be used exclusively for the masses said for the repose of the souls of the person or persons commemorated. But the aspect of the bronze enclosure revealed by the indentures that is most surprising, at least in relation to what we see today, is that it was meant to function as a support for 100 wax tapers, each 9 feet high and 12 pounds in weight. 9 feet is almost as high as the enclosure itself. The need to support and stabilize more than half a ton of wax must account for the very large quantities of cast iron introduced into the covings at the top of the enclosure. You can see these are solid pigs of cast iron, adding weight and vertical thrust. The basic idea embodied in the candlestick function of the bronze enclosure was not new. The requirement in the indentures that 100 tapers burn at the anniversaries and 4 of them burn continuously conformed to established Westminster usage in relation to the commemorations of Henry III, Eleanor of Castile, Richard II and his queen, and Henry V. In Gloucester Cathedral, there is a stone screen around the monument of Edward II, which has provision for perpetually burning tapers. But the visual impact of the bronze enclosure at Westminster, which was evidently once entirely gilded, must have been quite breathtaking, particularly when all of its 100 tapers were lit. It is clear that this was being thought of as a permanent version of the kind of hearse or catafalque, which was normally a temporary structure. On the left is one of the earliest portrayals I know of such a hearse, about 1380. And on the right is the well-known representation of the spectacular hearse of John Islip, Abbot of Westminster, who died in 1532 and who had assisted Henry VII in various ways in connection with the building and endowing of the new Lady Chapel. The way in which the Abbey was obliged to sign up to elaborate provisions for maintaining the tapers on the permanent hearse exemplifies to perfection the control freak aspect of the king's personality. One of those rules was that if any of the four tapers standing in the large crown-shaped drip pans at the centres of the sides were to be left unlit for more than half an hour during the daytime, that would incur a fine of 3 shillings and 4p, a good deal more than most people in early 16th century England earned in a week. The indentures offer no help with the problem of where exactly in the chapel Henry VII intended the bronze enclosure and the tomb to stand. The king's will, drawn up on the 31st of March 1509, just 3 weeks before his death, says simply that we will that our tomb be in the midst of the same chapel before the high altar in such distance from the same as is ordered in the plat made for the same chapel and signed with our hands. A plat is an architectural plan or design, and in passing it may be mentioned that the plat signed by Henry VII almost certainly consisted of much more than just a single drawing. The plat made for a range of buildings at Eton College in 1516, a structure that is simplicity itself compared to Westminster's Lady Chapel, consisted of an entire book of drawings. Elsewhere in the will, it is clear that the combined chantry chapel and candlestick was to be placed as close as it conveniently could be to the high altar, and therefore that is where I've shown it in my plan. It is difficult to imagine how the monks occupying the choir stalls to either side of this towering structure would ever have been able to feel that they were occupying a single liturgical space. The exceptional height at which the seats of the stalls are placed must have been an attempt to cope with this problem. The photo on the right, which was taken during the restoration of the chapel in 1994-5, when the steps up to the main upper stalls had been removed. You can see that the bases of the supports of the main arcade, which were already set high, were concealed from view completely when the decision was taken to set the seats at an even higher level. No doubt the non-arrival of the relics of St. Henry will have caused dismay at Westminster, but I cannot help wondering whether relief might have been the reaction when, around 1515, the decision was taken to install the tomb and the bronze enclosure on the site originally intended to be occupied by the shrine. Neither the indentures nor the will makes any mention of the four unglazed bay windows which projected into the main space from the easternmost bays of the north and south aisles and from the westernmost of the five chapels that radiate out from the apse. I can see them, I don't know whether you can. The western pair were demolished in order to extend the choir stalls eastward in the early 18th century, and of the eastern pair, all that remains is their solid lowest parts. Fortunately, one clear view was taken before the changes, and this you can see on the lower left. I've argued that these were closets or oratories that would have afforded privacy to members of the royal family or other elite figures attending the masses forming part of the weekly obits, which were celebrated at the chantry altar in the bronze enclosure, or the anniversary masses, which were to be celebrated at the main lady altar. Closets equipped with bay windows looking into chapels are documented in English royal residences from the late 14th century onwards, although the earliest surviving example is that on the north side of the sanctuary of St. George's, Windsor, which you see on the right. There's no possibility that I could even sketch all of the other functions that Henry VII's Lady Chapel fulfilled in the 38 years separating the deaths of Henry VII and Henry VIII. But if we want to have any kind of mental picture of what happened here, we need to remember the burials in the side aisles, the most important of which was that of Lady Margaret Beaufort in the south aisle, the 13 almsmen from the almshouse that Henry VII built at the west end of the precinct, who are required to say prayers kneeling or sitting around the bronze chantry enclosure during the masses for the king and queen's souls that took place daily at 7 a.m. and 8 a.m., and the laity who flocked to the chapel at Ascension Tide to take advantage of the Scala Coeli indulgence, the only kind of indulgence which enabled prayers to secure the immediate release of souls from purgatory. The Lady Chapel will have been viewed by a large section of the general population as a stimulant to pay for the soul of their late king, to pray for the soul of their late king, as a source of spiritual as a source of spiritual benefit to themselves and, of course, as an object of wonder. There can be no doubt that Westminster Abbey became a more frequented place than it had been before. And in fact, just the other day I found a will in which someone was setting up a chantry, and they said people were always worried about the morals of their chantry priests, and these chaps were not to go and be confessors at Westminster Abbey during the Scala Coeli indulgence. I mean, there was serious money to be made. The king had made provision for that. So when I said flocked to the chapel at Ascension Tide, I'm sure that did actually happen. Before leaving the documentary evidence, it's worth noting that Henry VII's will is particularly valuable for what it says about elements that had not yet been made in the spring of 1509. For example, it specifies the iconography of the 5-foot-high gold altarpiece of the chantry altar within the bronze enclosure. And one can only wonder whether the executors secured the cooperation of Henry VIII that would have been needed to realize such a sumptuous part of the ensemble. Certainly when the will was written, nothing had yet been done about the vestments and ornaments needed for the 7 lesser altars in the chapel. After the list of what was to be provided, we hear the authentic voice of Henry VII controlling to the very end. "And as for the price and value of them, our mind is that they be of such as appertain to the gift of a prince. And therefore we will that our executors have a special regard and consideration to the Lord of God and the wealth of our soul and our honour royal." The phrase "of such as appertain to the gift of a prince" was repeated in connection with the stained glass, which likewise had not been begun. I want now to outline the importance of the chapel in the history of late medieval architecture. I shall do this by setting the chapel in a series of contexts as briefly as I know how. The first of these contexts is the English royal tradition of the patronage of church architecture at its most ambitious level, what is often referred to for convenience as the Great Church. For slightly under half a millennium, the kings of England were patrons of great church architecture to an unparalleled extent. No other of medieval Christendom's monarchies produced a series of great church buildings that is comparable in ambition and artistic importance. The series starts with Edward the Confessor's reconstruction of Westminster Abbey in the 1050s and ends with the Westminster Lady Chapel. Many products of the tradition were obliterated as a result of the dissolution of the monasteries under Henry VIII, but what remains easily recognisable as its high point in terms both of ambition and cost is Henry III's rebuilding of Westminster Abbey from 1245. In France, the only significant royal church building project undertaken in the 15th century was Charles VII and Louis XI's church at Cléry near Orléans, built between 1434 and 1487. I don't think I need to labour the point that it does not bear comparison with the chief works of those King's English contemporaries. The second context in which the Westminster Lady Chapel needs to be viewed is the English tradition of large semi-autonomous lady chapels attached to major churches. The early 13th century building which it replaced was a single space, and in this it resembled every other example of this building type, including the grandest of all, the Lady Chapel at Ely Cathedral, built at Ely Cathedral from 1321. The Lady Chapel, which Henry VII built at the east end of St. George's, Windsor in the 1490s, which I mentioned earlier, was of this type. Westminster's Lady Chapel was thus unprecedented in being treated like a reiteration of the east arm of the great church to which it was attached. The view on the right brings this out, this second church aspect, very clearly. The key to this unique choice of the great church format was undoubtedly the intention that the relics of the canonized Henry VI be enshrined and placed in the apse behind the main altar. Parity with the shrine chapel of St. Edward the Confessor behind the high altar in the main church was established by making the main vessel exactly as wide and long as that of the eastern arm, and by ensuring that the floor level matched that of the confessor's chapel. The third of the contexts in which I want to place the chapel is the English perpendicular style of Gothic architecture. The treatment of the side elevations of the main vessel is very clearly based on that of St. George's Chapel, Windsor, begun in 1475, and arguably the most elegant and accomplished example of the great church genre produced in 15th century England. The first architect of St. George's was the Oxford-based master mason Henry Jannins, and there is circumstantial evidence that after his death, sometime in the mid or late 1480s, he was succeeded by his son Robert Jannins, whom I mentioned earlier as the most likely candidate for designer of this building. As is obvious in these photographs, I hope, the two buildings share an enormous amount, including their three-tier clerestory windows and very flattened four-centered arches, often called Tudor arches. Also their serried rows of angels rendered as busts, which I imagine the idea behind those is that of a service going on in heaven parallel with the services here on earth. That's a very ancient idea to refer to in the Benedictine rule. In fact, the resemblances extend to minute details that we don't need to be concerned with. What is obvious in these slides is that Westminster is far more richly treated than Windsor. The most prominent of the enrichments is the substitution of rows of statues in niches rather than the characteristic perpendicular panelling found at Windsor. This is architectural competitiveness at its most pointed and most personal. For the builder of St. George's, Edward IV, the father of Henry's wife, Elizabeth of York, had twice attempted to extradite Henry from his exile in Brittany, with the intention, no doubt, that he would suffer the same fate as Henry VI and his son. I think we can be quite sure that Edward IV's memory was not cherished by Henry VII. A clear indication of that is the way in which Henry, during the whole of his 24-year reign, declined to do anything to complete Edward's tomb at Windsor. The high vault of the chapel is an example of fan vaulting, a type of vault that is peculiar to English perpendicular architecture. The earliest example is in the building you see on the right, the cloister of St. Peter's Abbey, Gloucester, now Gloucester Cathedral, which was begun in the 1350s. These vaults are of the classic form incorporating inverted half cones with a curved profile that makes them look like the bells of trumpets cut in half. If you consult the plan on the right, you will see that they sit over bays that are square in plan. Exact square. This means that the rims of the half carved trumpet bells form horizontal semicircles that meet at the center of each bay. The clarity and perfection of the three-dimensional geometry is underscored by the absolute regularity of the surface treatment, which is a decorative pattern of tracery based on the tracery of rose windows. All earlier vaults in Gothic architecture are made up of thin arches or ribs, and no matter how complex the patterns that these ribs form, they are the only parts of the vault to be built from good jointed ashlar masonry, whereas the cells or webs in between these ribs are made of rubble plastered to a smooth finish. The classic form of fan vault represented by those at Gloucester is not built from two types of masonry. It is made entirely of very precisely shaped stones forming a thin shell. At least that is the theory, but the reality is that almost all large fan vaults revert at least partially to the traditional building technique. That applies even to the famous fan vaults which Henry VII commissioned for King's College Chapel in Cambridge. The one and only large fan vault that followed the Gloucester technique of being built entirely out of dressed stone is the high vault of the Lady Chapel at Westminster. And so on a purely technical plane, the vault over our heads is a tour de force. The other aspect of the vault that is illuminated by comparison with the Gloucester cloister is a complication that arises every time fan vaulting is used over bays that are rectangles in plan rather than squares. In virtually every great church, the central space is treated as a succession of rectangular bays, and you only have to look at the picture on the left or to look up at the real thing to see that the distance across the chapel is several times greater than the distance between the supports on the main longitudinal axis. Fitting fan vaults onto bays of rectangular plan is a problem which at Gloucester arose in just a single bay. The Gloucester designer chose to make the fans in this bay as similar to those over the other bays as he possibly could, but on the transverse axis, the fans curtail one another and meet to form straight lines. The design of the tracery on the surface of the mutually curtailing fans of the one rectangular bay does not strike me as particularly pleasing. Whereas in the Westminster Lady Chapel, it is hard to see how it could possibly have been managed better. Robert Jennings's father, Henry, had designed extremely beautiful fan vaults for the side aisles of the choir of St. George's, Windsor, where the bays are square in plan. But over the central vessel, he declined to use fan vaults. Almost certainly, he thought that designing fan vaults that would fit over the extremely elongated rectangular bays here was just too difficult. I don't think it would be unduly fanciful to imagine that when Henry VII and his architect discussed the possibilities for the high vault, the part of the building which, according to the English tradition of great church design, had to be treated as the climax of the interior, the king asked Robert Jennings what he thought the ideal form of vault would be. If the reply was a fan vault, and if the king picked up the slightest hint that Jennings thought that his father had ducked out of the opportunity to make the high vault of St. George's follow the most ambitious prototypes, that would surely have been sufficient to pique the king's competitive urges vis-à-vis his unloved father-in-law's chief architectural project. The most virtuosic feature of the vault is its large pendants, which seem to defy gravity. The earliest of England's few large-scale pendant vaults is that over the choir of St. Frideswyde's Abbey in Oxford, now Christ Church Cathedral. In a paper which I've never got around to publishing, I redated this vault to circa 1370 rather than circa 1490, which is the conventional dating. But the main points I want to make now are that this vault will have been well known to Robert Jennings, it's in his hometown, and that its kinship with the Westminster vault is another piece of evidence that points towards his authorship of the design. A very specific borrowing from the Oxford vault is the treatment of the transverse arches that spring from the vault shafts. They disappear from sight once they encounter the pendants, their central sections being above the vault and hence invisible from the floor. The bold cusping that hangs from the undersides of the transverse arches at Westminster is continued all the way across the chapel, even though the central parts of the transverse arches themselves can be seen only from the roof space above the vault. The use of cusping to define the boundaries between bays had only one precedent in perpendicular architecture. This is the fan vault over the chantry chapel of Bishop John Alcock in Ely Cathedral, begun in 1488. Visually and technically, this vault is so similar to those in the aisles of St. George's, Windsor, that it can be attributed with confidence to one or other of the Jenningses. And therefore, the pendant cusping in Henry VII's chapel is yet another indication that the designer was Robert Jennings. After what I've said, it will not come as a surprise that the vaults over the side aisles and chapels at Westminster go one better than the aisle vaults at Windsor. Both are fan vaults, but whereas Windsor has flat areas at the centre of every compartment, Westminster has pendants. The most remarkable touch in the lower-level vaults at Westminster is the way in which they simply stop at their outer edges without an arch enclosing them, such as there is at their inner edges. Just nothing there, an edge. And I'm going to compare it to this at Windsor. This makes each vault look almost like a canvas awning. The illusion of near weightlessness is enhanced by the decision to treat the periphery of the building not as conventional walls, but as a series of projecting bay windows, of which more anon. The way in which the vaults seem to float free from the undulations of the outer walls is, to my mind, one of the most beautiful and original effects in the whole of Gothic architecture. The only recent precedent for vaults that lack solid enclosing arches and walls was in St. George's, Windsor, at the west end of the part of the North Choir aisle which runs under Edward IV's Chantry Chapel. This is, of course, yet another indication that the designer was... Sorry to overdo it, but he does need the publicity. The density of the ornamentation of the aisle vaults at Westminster, and indeed of the chapel as a whole, leave little doubt that one of the aims when drawing up the design was to emulate the levels of richness previously attained only in the most sumptuous chantry chapels. The chantry of Cardinal Beaufort in Windsor, in Winchester Cathedral, probably begun in the 1440s, illustrates this point as well as any example of the genre. Whether or not Janins knew this particular chantry chapel, its papery-looking fan vaults are remarkable anticipations of the insubstantial hovering aspect of the lower vaults at Westminster. The desire to give to an entire building the level of richness found in chantry chapels, which are, after all, comparatively small structures, is a clear indication of Henry VII's determination that the Westminster Lady Chapel should be an entirely exceptional building. A further feature of the chapel, which reveals Janins' familiarity with St. George's, Windsor, is its singular use of bay windows. Bay windows had been part of English domestic architecture from at least the early 14th century, and needless to say, ecclesiastical architecture was not their natural habitat. At St. George's, the main aim seems to have been to devise a long south facade that would dominate the lower courtyard of the castle in very much the same way as the upper courtyard was dominated by the facade of the royal lodgings built a century earlier under the third King Edward, for this latter incorporated several faceted projections resembling bay windows. But if St. George's was the source, what I'm talking about are these. See, there are no buttresses. They don't look very churchy at all. They look much more like the kind of thing you might expect to find in an aristocratic residence. But if St. George's was the source of the idea of incorporating bay windows into the lower level of the Westminster Lady Chapel, and I'm pretty sure that it was, the form of the bay windows themselves had a quite different origin. In the early 17th century, the antiquary and polymath John Aubrey noted the similarity between the complex bay windows on the Lady Chapel and those on the royal lodgings of Windsor Manor, the most splendid new palatial residence built by Henry VII. Richmond, which was most unfortunately demolished during the Commonwealth, was a totally new structure rebuilt after a fire in 1497, almost certainly to the designs of Robert Janins. Part of my reason for thinking that this is the only... Part of my reason for thinking this is that the only other examples at this date of the kind of complex bay windows formerly at Richmond and still to be seen at Westminster are those on the so-called Henry VII Tower at Windsor. This was a new block containing the innermost chambers of the king and was built from 1499. Janins is actually documented as the master mason of this remarkable building. The origins of this new type of bay window are not terribly obvious, but I must resist the temptation to speculate about the sources of Westminster's Lady Chapel. The other two aspects of the exterior of the Lady Chapel, two other aspects of the exterior of the Lady Chapel lay outside contemporary norms. The one which is easier to discuss succinctly is the dense grid of perpendicular panelling which encompasses all parts of the elevations, whether glazed or solid, unifying and enriching them in spectacular fashion. Previously, the only parts of major English churches treated in this way had been east and west facades. The other non-standard feature of the exterior is the use of small domes rather than pinnacles at the tops of the buttresses. These domelets, as I have got into the way of calling them, are perhaps the aspect of the chapel which has the most intriguing ramifications. But because those ramifications extend far beyond late medieval architectural history, I must again restrain myself and be content with a brief discussion of one or two aspects only. If one looks hard enough, one can find domelets in many places, especially in German Romanesque. But I'm fairly certain that the starting point of interest in this form in the late Middle Ages was not architecture as such, but rather the imaginative renderings of the Jerusalem temple in the works of Netherlandish painters starting from the late 14th century. On the right is a comparatively late example by Roger van der Weyden, dating from around 1440, part of the background of a crucifixion triptych. I've chosen it because it invites comparison with what must have been the most spectacular examples of domelets in English architecture, even more dramatic than those on the exterior of the Lady Chapel at Westminster. These are the multi-tiered domelets on the Royal Lodgings block of Windsor Manor, whose bay windows we considered a moment ago. Like the dome of the temple rendered by van der Weyden, they were painted blue with gold trim. Their pinnacles and playfully curvilinear flying buttresses are not paralleled in the van der Weyden painting, but they can be seen in other Netherlandish painters' fantasy versions of the Jerusalem temple. The Richmond domelets, which lost their buttresses and pinnacles under the parsimonious maintenance regime followed by Elizabeth I, were constructed from timber covered with lead. What might have been the earliest English examples of lead-covered domelets were added to the south transept of Westminster Abbey in 1479-80, but it's likely that domelets were intended to feature at St. George's, Windsor, from the very beginning, that is, from 1475. Edward IV, who had visited the Low Countries under less than ideal circumstances in 1470-71, is known to have been greatly impressed by contemporary art there, and it's highly likely that by then domelets were starting to appear in actual buildings and church furnishings. A piece of church furnishing that is of interest to me because it parallels the two-tier type painted by van der Weyden and built at Richmond Manor is the canopy of the pulpit in the church of St. Barbo at Haarlem in Holland, dating from 1490. The Haarlem pulpit canopy also compares quite well with the domelets surmounting the choir stalls in the chapel. Sorry, not caught up. Which is a precisely dated object. There's a great deal about the stalls that indicates that their makers were Netherlandish. By this date, it seems clear that in architecture, the domelet had turned into little more than a fashionable flourish and that it had shed its capacity to evoke the Jerusalem temple and pre-Christian antiquity generally. I suspect strongly that it was the domelets of Richmond, which in 1506 so impressed the Duke of Burgundy and King Designate of Castile, Philip the Handsome, that he was moved to announce to his entourage that he hoped to build something similar at his palace in Brussels. And the fact that that is a report by one of his entourage rather than a sort of Englishman helping himself to a bit of Henry VII's glory, it makes me think that that was an actual remark he made when he saw Richmond. Another aspect of what I can't resist calling Netherlandish retro is very prominent on the bronze enclosure around the royal tomb. The maker of this prodigious piece of casting is recorded as Thomas Dutchman, and I think one should probably assume that he was also the designer. If he was, it's remarkable how fully he had managed to assimilate the English traditions of screen design, and there is always the possibility of collaboration with English craftsmen, perhaps even with Robert Jannins himself. But the most eye-catching and exotic features are the openwork columns at each corner. These could hardly be more remote from mainstream late Gothic architecture. That was indeed the original point about these aggressively neo-Romanesque forms, which make their first major appearance in Netherlandish art around 1420 in the betrothal of the Virgin in the Prado, you see on the right. On the left, we see the temple, on the left in the picture, we see the temple treated as a kind of rotunda, complete with elaborately variegated patterned columns of kinds that the artist may well have himself encountered in Romanesque churches, crypts especially. The Romanesque-style temple is here a symbol of the old law that is about to be superseded by the new dispensation represented by the partly built Gothic structure. By the later 15th century, Netherlandish craftsmen of all kinds were incorporating neo-Romanesque patterned columns without any symbolic content. This trend is exemplified by the metalwork of the lost late 15th century shrine of St. Rombout at Mechelen, which is probably represented accurately in this detail from one of a series of panels devoted to the saints' miracles that were painted around 1500. That's the image in the middle. Note the use of different patterns in the upper and lower halves, as in Henry VII's bronze enclosure. This particular pattern is pretty close. In England, the most obvious manifestation of this strand of taste was in elaborately decorated brick chimneys. These are popularly thought of as Tudor, but they were almost certainly being produced several decades before 1485, initially by Netherlandish specialists and afterwards by English craftsmen. They featured very prominently at Richmond Manor. Incidentally, the image of the bronze enclosure on the left shows that it has lost a multitude of heraldic enrichments since 1660. Regarding the internal sculpture of the chapel, I want to make only three points. The first is that such prodigal use of life-sized or almost life-sized statues internally was absolutely exceptional within the English tradition of great church design. Clearly, the aim was that the chapel should take on as much as possible of the character of a chantry chapel, for virtually all the major examples of that kind of structure were densely populated by full-length images standing in niches. These statues are 20th century, but the point is well made by them. This complements what I said earlier about the chantry-like qualities of the architecture, especially the aisle vault. The second point I want to make about the sculpture is that I concur completely with Philip Lindley's judgment that nearly all the statues of saints and prophets were the work of sculptors who are trained in the Low Countries, most likely in Brabant. Some of these are of remarkably high quality. During the mid and late 15th century, English sculptors, and indeed English artists generally, had failed to master the new realism emanating from the Low Countries. And for those patrons who wanted good quality works in the Netherlandish manner, it must have seemed simpler to employ Netherlandish artists. As Sir Thomas Eliot wrote in his courtesy book, The Governor, in 1531, if we will have anything well painted, carved, or embroidered, we are constrained to leave our countrymen and resort unto strangers. By the early 16th century, there were numerous sculptors of Netherlandish origin working in London. Edward IV had given them important commissions, and there's no reason to suppose that Henry VII would have had any compunction about doing the same. To him, it will have been obvious that England was not self-sufficient in high-quality sculpture as it was in architecture. The third thing I want to say about the figure sculpture is a further point borrowed from Philip Lindley. This is that the failure to follow the stipulation of Henry VII's will that every figure should be fully polychrome, in accordance with medieval norms, must have ensured that the stained glass, and here I quote him, until its destruction in 1642, must have visually dominated the still monochrome sculptural ensemble. The lost glazing of the chapel was the work of the Netherlandish glazier Barnard Flower, and its extensive use of areas of rich saturated colour can be visualised by comparison with what is almost certainly another work of his, the glass at Fairford Church in Gloucestershire. A high proportion of the sculpture in the Lady Chapel is heraldic and quasi-heraldic. The beasts that perch on top of the image niches at the lower level are not nearly so well known as the much larger and more prominent examples in King's College Chapel, but they are conceived and executed with similar flair, very probably by the same English team as was responsible for the beasts at King's. Marvellously snooty greyhound looking down on the carved badges that appear in many parts of the interior and exterior are only one example of a vogue for applying these personal devices to buildings and other kinds of artifacts. Possibly the earliest example anywhere in Europe is the use of the white heart device of Richard II on his rebuilding of Westminster Hall from 1394. But in Henry VII's buildings, what had been a sprinkling becomes a relentless peppering. The beaker on the left was made for the king's mother, as the marguerites indicate. But I suspect its incrustation with badges makes it representative of many of the luxury objects made for Henry. The Stonyhurst cope, which is the only reasonably complete survivor of the 29 copes made in Florence for use in the king's commemorations in the Lady Chapel, leaves one in no doubt whatever regarding the identity of the patron. Even the chasubles worn by the celebrant and his assistants bore the royal badges, although none of these has survived. I cannot go into the meanings of Henry VII's badges this evening, but the symbolism of the best known of them, the red and white Tudor rose, was that the Lancastrian Yorkist royal lines not only converged, but culminated in the union between Henry and Elizabeth of York. At the start of this lecture, I noted that historians have generally experienced difficulty when attempting to define the importance of Henry VII. It seems likely that this king and his reign will always remain an unfashionable field of study, as they fall between two far more dramatic epochs, the Wars of the Roses and the secession of England from the Roman obedience under Henry VIII and Edward VI. Once Henry VII had won his kingdom at Bosworth, his reign saw relatively few dramas, and certainly nothing that could have inspired Shakespeare to write one of his historical plays. For me, as a historian of architecture, the importance of Henry VII is pretty clear. He was one of the greatest architectural patrons, not only in his own time, but of all time. Like all great architectural patrons, he realized that he had to be rich before he could initiate major building projects. And it's significant that Henry's involvement in such projects started only after he had been on the throne for around 15 years, by which time he had amassed considerable wealth. As Francis Bacon put it so memorably, the felicity of full coffers enabled him to keep state and majesty to the height. But being a great patron of architecture entails having at one's disposal a great architect, and Robert Jannins was certainly that. Today, he is a very obscure figure, thanks to the general mishandling of the evidence for the authorship of Westminster's Lady Chapel, but principally to the loss of the building accounts. I can only hope that he was commemorated in the stained glass as he or his successor at St. George's, Windsor, was. The figure at Windsor remains, but the identifying inscription has unfortunately been lost. But, of course, this is just speculation on my part. I'm afraid I don't have a satisfactory picture of the Windsor image of the Master Mason. The important point is that Henry VII was no different from the patrons of all of England, medieval England's other great church buildings in not wanting to share the glory with his architect. Over and above its beauty and its inventiveness, this chief product of Henry VII's patronage demonstrates the capacity of the great church genre to remain what it had always been, the top genre in medieval architecture. Its bay windows undoubtedly derived from secular architecture, but they are far more numerous and more splendid than any secular example. I am convinced that Henry VII and Robert Jannins were fully conscious of creating a building that represented the culmination of the distinctively English tradition which we call perpendicular architecture. Throughout the 16th century, it attracted praise beyond that lavished on any other English building, and not just from English commentators either. In 1545, the antiquary John Leyland pronounced the chapel to be Miraculum Orbis Universali. And if we modestly translate that as a marvel rather than the marvel, there are unlikely to be many who will disagree. Thank you.